won't get me here. Oh, 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 oh.
His name was Buck Harp. Historically, a lot of people think that his name was Buck Harper, but this is not true at all. Buck was a freedman. And as a freedman, he got to cast off the last name of the white man who had claimed to own him and his family, and he got to choose his own name. Buck was not a man of letters. Like a lot of former slaves, he couldn't read, nor could he write. All of the proper last names that he knew were from white folks. And this would not do for Buck. He remembered that when she was alive, they'd called his mother Mama Harp because of her angelic voice and her musical ability. So he took that as his last name and became Buck Harp. In time, Buck had a wife and three sons and a fairly respectable area of land that he had been successfully sharecropping for a number of years. The farming was his work, but for extra money and for pleasure, he was a woodworker. He made furniture for his house, for his friends, and when he had spare wood, he would build and donate pine boxes to local black churches, who oftentimes couldn't afford such luxuries as coffins. There's no doubt that Buck was a decent man, but he was not a religious man. And this got in the way of his social standing, because donating coffins to old freedmen and women who had passed on, that was one thing. But abiding by the rules and regulations and requirements of a white god, this did not set right with him. Not one little bit. When asked, and he had to be asked, he would never volunteer it, Buck would admit that he felt, personally, that the church was a tool meant to keep black people calm and to keep them in line. More than once, he'd been known to say, "God never helped me plant crops, and the devil neither, so neither one of them are worth a damn." This well-known disdain for religion made it very easy for people to believe it when it started being said that Buck met the devil at the crossroads, that he had traded his soul for a set of unholy tools, that he stopped planting crops and started burying Klansmen. This is the story of Buck Harp. I call it Up Jump the Devil. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters and mayhem, killers, cannibals and cults, fearful fiction and furious fact, tall tales and terrible truths. This is a Scary Home Companion. At the outset, the Ku Klux Klan was racist incidentally. Only because, you know, everyone was a fucking racist back then. Really, the KKK started as a social club for men. It was founded in 1866 by a group of former Confederate generals. Within just a couple of years, the name and the symbolism had been co-opted and spread throughout the South. Most of these Klan groups had no real connection to one another. See, back then it wasn't a big organized force of racism. It was just a bunch of splinter cells that all called themselves the same thing. Most of those cells were politically motivated, and a lot of them targeted freedmen and their allies. And while they were fairly effective when it came to lynchings, beatings, and arson and intimidation, the Klan could never really organize themselves enough to make a political difference. In 1870, just a few years after it kicked off, the government passed enforcement protocols targeting the Klan, and at that point they just sort of went away. Sort of. There were other paramilitary racist groups that emerged in their place, a lot of them more violent and fragmented and anti-government than ever before. Something that I would like to impress on you when I'm talking about the Klan and the KKK, the history of the Klan really isn't just about one group of good old boys called the Ku Klux Klan. When I say that, the Klan really represents a movement, a feeling, and a very widespread one, might I add. And this feeling existed whether or not the men in the white hoods were there. Speaking of which, did you know that the white hoods didn't come until much later with the second iteration of the Klan? I'm getting ahead of myself. So, just before Ulysses Grant got elected president, there was a real upswing in violent Klan activity. There were a lot of lynchings, a lot of fires, a lot of churches defiled and destroyed, and a lot of innocent people hurt. And when it comes to Buck Harp and his family, this is the way the Klan tells it. Buck was in town, and some Klansmen saw him looking inappropriately at a white woman. But then they also tell it that Buck was in town riling up the local blacks to go vote for Grant. The way everyone else tells it, Buck was just in town getting supplies. He was a craftsman, he was a farmer, and he was doing very well across the board. He happened to cross paths with a group of unemployed Klansmen, and that's all it took. These men saw him, and then they started talking about how they hated him, and how they hated what he stood for, and how he needed to be reminded of what his place was. And so this group of men, getting riled up and drunk, waited until night fell, and they went out to Buck's place. And they set fire to his house, and they hung Buck from the tree in his front yard. And then they hung his three sons, and finally, they lynched his wife. Buck was a strapping man with a lifetime of manual labor behind him. He had a very thick neck. When the Klansmen strung him up, they didn't yank him down to break his neck, as was the custom. So he was just hanging there with his hands bound, dangling inches off the ground, watching on as the rest of his family died. He faded in and out of consciousness. Everything seemed to happen in slow motion and time lapse all at once for him. And as horrific as the lynching was, as horrific as every lynching is, imagine how much worse it was. It must have been to be trapped, bound, completely helpless, watching on as your family dies right in front of your eyes. What sort of thing must that do to a human mind? Buck screamed. He screamed out loud for vengeance. He screamed so deeply and so wrenchingly that it permanently ruined his voice box and he never spoke again. It was a howl of pain and loss, so loud and deep that the devil heard it down in hell. Buck was still hanging there, barely alive, still looking at his dead family, when a man appeared and cut him down. It was a black man, but this was not like any black man Buck had ever seen before. He wore a finer suit than a politician, and even in the middle of this burnt, bloody field, his shoes gleamed. Buck knew right away who he was looking at. "Are you ready?" the devil asked him. Buck shook his head. And the devil nodded. Well, you know where to find me when you are ready. And he went on his way. Buck cut down his family. He washed them. He dressed them. He laid them out fine. He cut down the tree where they had died, and he processed it, and he turned it into boards. He built four coffins and found that he had wood enough for four more. He dug five graves and filled in four of them with his family, leaving one open and empty for himself to join them. He marked those graves with crosses made of sticks, and then he went to the crossroads to find the devil. According to Southern lore, if you wait at a crossroads at midnight, the devil will come walking by. If you come to him with an ask, it's customary to bring a token of respect, like a cigar or a bottle of rum. Buck Harp went, but he wasn't asking for anything. He stood at the crossroads at midnight, arms folded, and he waited. When the devil appeared, Buck just stared him down. At this point, he didn't fear death, he didn't fear God, and he for damn sure didn't fear the devil. The devil, for his part, had come ready for this meeting. This time, he was the one with an ask, and he was the one that brought a token of respect for Buck. It was a box of old woodworking tools. Very old, pitted, but still strong. The devil explained, "These were the tools of the Nazarene, and I want you to use them for me. You use them to build, and I will show you the four men who did this to your family." Buck nodded and picked up the tools. The devil wrote down four names on a scrap of paper. Of course, Buck couldn't read, so the devil showed him an old hoodoo magic trick. He put a pinch of tobacco into that scrap of paper and rolled it up like a cigarette. When Buck smoked it through, he saw the men's faces in his head. He heard their names in his ears. He knew where they lived and what they had done. Over the next two nights, those four men all went missing. Buck took them from their homes as they slept. He bound them and stuffed them each into a box made of wood from that hanging tree. He bound each box with a length of lynching rope taken from around the necks of his family. And he found that with that rope, once tied into a knot, he didn't even have to nail the coffin shut. That dark magic, that bloody rope, sealed those men in inescapably. And then he buried the four of them alive, one by one. He marked each grave with an upside-down cross made of bound sticks. And then he sat down in his rocking chair, he smoked some tobacco, and he listened to the four men screaming from beneath the earth. They were still screaming the next day. What else was there to do down there, I guess, right? Imagine being trapped away, locked inside a box, buried under 6 feet of earth. What could you do but scream and beg for release? But they kept on with it. Day after day, night after night, until Buck finally understood that they were never going to stop. They were not going to die. These four men were never going to move on to their heavenly reward, nor their eternal damnation in a pit of fire. These four men would stay right here with Buck, buried alive, in endless silence, endless darkness, endless nothing, until the end of the earth. If this pleased Buck, he didn't show it. That night, something roused him from his sleep. Buck went out front to see the devil sitting in his rocking chair. He brought Buck another bottle of rum, and they sat together, side by side, sipping rum and listening to the wails of the clansmen under the earth. "You've got a lot of land here," the devil said. "A lot of room to plant." Buck understood all too clearly that the work was not yet done. After all, he was a sharecropper at heart, and he always produced a bumper crop. The next morning, Buck hitched up his horses to the wagon and he loaded up all of his saws. If he was going to make more coffins, he needed more rope and more wood of a very special variety. So he went out searching the south for lynching trees, and he always made sure to keep the ropes. He scouted out old abandoned plantations, looking for any wooden shacks or structures that had been soaked in blood or suffering. He found old gallows. He found stocks that had been used to keep slaves bound for whippings. He found former slave quarters that had been used for birthing, others for punishment, and some even for sexual assault. In every case, the floorboards of these places were tinged maroon and seemed forever damp and sticky. Buck harvested the wood. He loaded up his wagon to capacity, and then he took it all back home, and he started making coffins. He started digging new graves. When all the work was finally done, Buck found a piece of paper waiting for him on his front door. There were words on it, three names. Since he couldn't read, he rolled it up, he smoked it, and then he saw the faces of guilty men, and he saw the places where they hung their hats. The next morning, he hitched up his horses again. He loaded up three coffins and three lengths of rope. And that was when Buck Harp stopped being a man avenging his family and started being a bona fide Southern legend.
"Jim, boy, what do you want me to tell you? What you want me to tell you? Oh, in them long, hot days, he said, you tell you left me rolling. Oh, in them long, hot summer days. But if that would be June, July, and
1915, the KKK had a huge resurgence. And this time, they'd learned from their mistakes. This time, they were organized. They had structure. They had a gimmick. They had outfits and costumes. They had handshakes and nomenclature. They had grand dragons and exalted cyclopes. They would hold huge convocations at the Clavern, officiated by the Caliph and the Imperial Clud, who would read from the Quran. 100% not kidding about any of that shit, by the way. Whereas before, the Klan had been a violent fraternity, this time, it was branded an organized terror. But it wasn't all sunshine and burning crosses for this generation of racial hatred. This iteration of the Klan had something else new. They had a boogeyman. As I said earlier, when there wasn't a KKK, there were still Klansmen, they just went under different names. There were the White Riders, the Southern Cross, Knights of the White Camilla, a lot of groups. But whatever name they went by, everybody heard about the old sharecropper. They told tales. They whispered legends. They said he had a wooden wagon pulled by hellhounds. They said the devil gave him instructions on how to hunt down the most righteous of God's white army. They said he used Jesus' own tools just for the sake of pure sacrilegious meanness. The Klan gave Buck a lot of names, most of which I cannot and will not say, but among the less offensive ones that he was branded with, Buck was called the devil's best friend, the coffin maker, the woodworker, the hood hunter, and my personal favorite, the Klan killer. Stories about Buck traveled all over the South. They said there was a lost plantation filled with human crops, and if you went to the top of Stone Mountain, Georgia, the place where the original Klan was founded, and the winds blew just right, you could hear the screams of those human crops. In all these different Klan meetings, in all these different states, they called Buck a lot of different names, they gave him all manner of backstories. They all said he came from somewhere different, usually someplace close to them. But you couldn't find a Klan meeting in the South without at least one person there who knew somebody who'd gone missing. At this point, Buck had become a legend, a bedtime story that white folks used to scare their kids at night and to keep them from sneaking out. They'd say, "You stay home, you stay together, and you stay in the light, or the old sharecropper will stick you in a coffin and seal you up tight." As scary as the Klan was, and they most decidedly were scary as hell, even they had things that scared them. And they all shuddered at the thought of old Buck. They might have had new outfits, new names, new marching drills, but not a damn thing had changed, not from where Buck was sitting. The only difference now was that now he was collecting a white hood for each grave as a memento to hang on the crosses made out of sticks. This new Klan was a lot more secretive. They knew enough to hide their faces, but that didn't matter to Buck Harp. Because once the devil wrote down their names, once Buck rolled up that cigarette, he saw their true face in the smoke, and no hood or mask could hide that. Over the years, his graveyard had grown. There were now several rows of graves, dozens of them, dozens of upside-down crosses in the ground, dozens of voices wailing from 6 feet deep. the devil still came by every so often. Buck had built a second rocking chair just for him, because the devil was the only company that he ever got on his time-swept piece of land. Every time he came by, the devil always brought a bottle of liquor, and the two of them would just sit and rock, sipping liquor, the squeaking of the chairs offset by the chorus of buried screams. The lists of names kept coming, and Buck kept writing out. You might think that after so many years, Buck would run out of wood, but that's probably because you don't quite grasp how many lynching trees there were to harvest. From 1877 through 1950, there were some 3,500 African Americans lynched in this country, and that is a very conservative estimate. When you factor in the scorched boards that Buck could harvest from the burned crosses, the material he scavenged from the desecrated black churches, he had more than enough material. He had more wood than he could ever use. He never ran dry on coffin wood or blooded rope, and he never ran dry on anger. While he never stopped missing his family, not once did Buck ever question his work, because when he smoked the devil's cigarette, he not only saw the faces of the people on his list, he not only heard their names, he also saw why they were on it. Things might have played out differently if the devil had sent Buck after righteous men, but he never did. He never had to. There were so many ugly and demonic souls running loose in the world, people who so badly needed to suffer for all eternity. And Buck saw all of their atrocities in the smoke. So many bloody and dead black faces. So many young lives snuffed out due to pure, raw, unadulterated hate. You better be goddamn sure Buck never ran dry on anger. The second iteration of the Klan came and went just like the first. By 1930, membership had bottomed out. A few years previous, there had been 6 million active members of the Klan. 6 million active members, people that claimed membership in the Klan. By 1930, that number had gone to 30,000. That movement was splintered, it was scattered, operating under the banners of dozens of different names and factions, none of which mattered to Buck Harp. He wasn't punishing these men for wearing a white hood. It had never been about that. He was punishing these men for what they did to his people and what they did to the world. The hoods, they went away. They'd become politically unfashionable. But the hearts and minds behind those hoods remained unchanged. And for his part, Buck hadn't changed either. Almost 100 years had passed at this point, but to him, it still felt like the first day. He still visited his family's graves every morning. They were still the only crosses set right side up in a sea of what was now hundreds. Dozens of rows, hundreds of graves as far as the eye could see, from one edge of his land to the other. Hundreds of upside-down crosses. Hundreds of old and dirty white hoods rustling in the breeze like wind socks. Hundreds of buried voices crying out. Hundreds of fists pounding on the insides of coffin lids. Hundreds of men and women who were never allowed to die, hundreds trapped inside pine boxes as their bodies wasted away, and they could feel every moment of it. Hundreds of people, right where they belonged.
Come along, come along. Let go of the bearing. Come along, come along. Let go of the bearing. Won't you come along, come along. Let go of the bearing. Way over in the new bearing ground. Then don't you hear my Lord calling. Sinner, don't you hear, my Lord calling? Oh, sinner, don't you hear, my Lord calling? Way over, over at the New America. All the hammer people ringing, ringing ain't somebody coughing. The hammer people ringing,
water boy,
somebody coughing. Oh, the hammer people ringing, ringing in somebody coughing. Way over,
come here, come here.
Over the New Galleon, where the hurt people rolling, rolling somebody to the graveyard. The hurt people rolling,
rolling
somebody
to the
graveyard. On the hills keep rolling, rolling somebody to the graveyard. Way over, over at the bearing ground.
Thank you for listening to what I think is an important episode of A Scary Home Companion. Please send feedback and your thoughts on the show to ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter as Nateflix, or on Facebook as A Scary Home Companion. Subscribe through Buzzsprout, iTunes, or Spotify. Jeff Davidson edited and helped produce this episode, in which we used some pretty amazing music. Song titles are Cornfield Holler, Have Mercy Lord, Run Old Jeremiah, Long Hot Summer Day, and we wrapped it up with New Burying Ground. For all of these songs, plus more amazing, authentic African-American music, follow the link in the show notes to The Sounds of Slavery, credited to T. David Franklin.